Scaredy Cats, welcome to the Haunted Library. This month's installment is all about the so-called Last Castle Rock story, Needful Things. I'm Sherry.
And I'm Ryan.
And we are the founding members of the Castle Rock Book Club. And I think this was the Castle Rock story that we were most looking forward to reading.
Oh, 100%. It's the Castle Rock story.
It really is. It really is. So the book description of Needful Things, Leland Gaunt opens a new shop in Castle Rock called Needful Things. Anyone who enters his store finds the object of his or her lifelong dreams and desires, a prized baseball card, a healing amulet. In addition to a token payment, Gaunt requests that each person perform a little deed, usually a seemingly innocent prank played on someone else from town. These practical jokes cascade out of control, and soon the entire town is doing battle with itself. Only Sheriff Alan Pangborn suspects that Gaunt is behind the population's increasingly violent behavior. First, I'm going to ask you, Ryan, what would Leland Gaunt hook you with?
I mean, you know me. I am such a shopper. I feel like three times a week we message each other and say, I bought this book. So it would probably be some sort of book, but it could also just be a nice candle. I would probably be like, oh, I like the jar.
I was going to say, I could see it also being like a candle that you really love that has been discontinued. And he's like, look.
100%.
Look at this huge, massive candle in this scent that you really like.
Well, what would yours be?
I think mine would probably also be some type of book. And I think we discussed this in the Castle Rock Book Club group, that you said that it would be like, you know, a like secret Stephen King book. Kind of, didn't you say that?
Oh, I think that was someone else.
Oh, was it? Like, it makes me think of Finders Keepers. And, like,
yeah,
somebody really wanting these hidden manuscripts that, like, King has, like, stored in his house. But I feel like that would be something. But I'd also just, this is so terrible. And it's probably because I haven't had dinner yet. But I'm like, he could probably get me with a really good taco.
So Needful Things is like a food truck in your world.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I'd probably fall for it.
Yeah, right? Maybe he tries that in another town, because we know Leland Gaunt goes from town to town and does this.
He sells his wares.
Sometimes it's tacos, sometimes it's books, candles, sometimes it's a Sandy Koufax baseball card.
Sometimes it's his body.
But nobody can stand the like his touch. I don't know that would
That's
work.
True. That's true.
King started this in 1988. He started writing it in 1988. He finished it in 1991. It was released in October of 91. I have no sense of time when it comes to things like this. And I always think, you know, that I often forget how early he started writing, because this is his 30th book.
It's insane. He was publishing for less than 20 years by the time this came out.
That's really prolific. Like, I can't imagine writing, and I mean, it's not like his books are short.
Oh no.
How many pages is this one? Like, it's 700 and something.
Yeah, depending on the edition, it's like over 750, I think. Maybe.
So what edition do you have?
I have I just have the mass market paperback. You know me, I love the mass market paperbacks.
Yeah, me too.
And I was actually going to say this when we were talking about our needful things, like our one item that would hook us. I try, because I'm such a spender, I try so hard to not get into the like collect-y side of Stephen King books, because that's a really dark and dangerous path to go down. So it's like, I've trained myself that I love mass market paperbacks, and that's what I have.
Yeah, I also have a mass market paperback that has been chewed and torn by one of my cats, who I woke up, I think I told you, I woke up one morning and heard this weird noise, and I'm like, what is that? And then I see my cat sitting on top of Needful Things, and he's chewing and like ripping the pages with his mouth, because he loves plastic and he loves paper. And so it's like, this is amazing. I just switched to the ebook when we were reading it, because I couldn't read the ending.
Oh, I mean, that's how I read all Stephen King books. I may own a copy, but I probably get it from the library on my Kindle.
Okay, so what came before it? So if we look at what came out in 1990 and 1991, The Stand came out in 1990. The Wastelands came out in 1991.
Well, and we should say The Stand originally came out in, what was it, 1980 or maybe the late 70s? And the original unabridged version was re-released right. in 1990, so like the complete and uncut, but The Stand was already pretty much a classic by then. And yeah, Dark Tower.
And then in 92, I know your favorite Stephen King book came out, Gerald's Game, and Dolores Claiborne.
Such, in this period in particular, I've said this before, this is King's like best time for me personally. Because starting in the late 90s, and I know like around that time, it was maybe 2000 or so that he had his car accident that mm-hmm. really almost stopped him writing altogether. But starting in the late 90s and continuing on through that, he went through kind of like a bland period for me. So it was like Bag of Bones, Duma Key, Lisey's Story, which not bad books, but they're all kind of like the same flavor.
Right.
And like you said, Gerald's Game, one of my faves. Also, I love The Dark Half. It's super good. Dolores Claiborne, Misery. Those are so good. And then Needful Things on top of all that. I mean, that it's just a really strong period.
Mm-hmm. Do you see like any of the same themes coming up with like the Wastelands, Gerald's Game, Dolores Claiborne, Needful Things? Any of that? Like, do you see similarities between any of them?
Not at all. Now that I think about it, yeah, they're so, I mean, obviously Dolores Claiborne and Gerald's Game have really strong ties. I don't know. That's a good question because it seems to me the first thing I think of when you mention all those titles are like, they're really about the place. Mm-hmm. So I just remember Gerald's Game being super atmospheric with the dark score lake and like the kind of summer house vibe. They all have their own really distinct sense of place, but mm-hmm. I can't imagine that that's intentional.
No, I think that's just something that he does very well. Like, I think he is a master of that, right?
Mm.
Of creating these places, these cities or towns where you're like, I guess they're not cities, they're smaller, they're towns. And you can like really imagine yourself like driving through that town and meeting some of these people. So I haven't read Dolores Claiborne in a long time, so I think I need to reread that. But, and you know, I haven't read any of the Dark Tower books because I am not a fantasy fan and that they just have never appealed to me, but I have committed to reading them.
If I can get through them, you can, because I'm not a big fantasy fan either.
Yeah. So it debuted at number 2 on the New York Times hardcover bestseller list and was knocked out of top position by Scarlet, the sequel to Gone with the Wind.
Wow.
It never actually reached number 1 on the New York Times hardcover bestseller list, and it was actually the first King book since his Bachman books failed to do so.
Wow. That must have been demoralizing.
Yeah, like, and we've talked about this. It wasn't considered one of his better novels, and in fact, when I look at reviews of it, they're not great for the most part.
I can't wrap my head around that. I really can't.
I know, because it's one of my favorites. It's up there for me, like with Salem's Lot and The Shining, like all of my totally. Favorites. So it also debuted at number 3 on the paperback list and never rose any higher. However, despite that, it was made into a movie in 1993 starring Ed Harris, Max von Sydow, and Bonnie Bedelia. And I know I've never seen the movie. You have not been able to get into the movie. So I haven't heard great things about that either.
Yeah, I just tried to impulse watch it once and I got maybe like 15 minutes in and just, it's like, I mean, the book is so good. It's like a top 10, everything King's published.
Yeah.
It's no Carrie, that's for sure.
is that the epitome for you? Like Carrie, is that the, like the best Stephen King adaptation?
That's a really good question. I would say, well, of course, there's The Shawshank and The Green Mile, which are like classics. And yes, they're very, very good. But I think when it comes to kind of like the niche of King's work, then Carrie's definitely got it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say Carrie and Misery are like the best Stephen King horror movies, horror adaptations. But I really like The Mist.
Yeah, I really like The Mist too. So really, Needful Things focuses on what King said when asked by the Paris Review. They asked what he thinks people are all afraid of. And he said, "What are we afraid of? As humans, chaos, the outsider. We're afraid of change. We're afraid of disruption. And that is what I'm interested in." And I think that like sums up Needful Things right there.
Oh, yeah, for sure. He's always fascinated by the idea of the outsider. But apart from Leland Gaunt, of course, a lot of the, it just seems more focused on how the people that we know turn on us and that kind of vibe a little bit more than maybe if it focuses on Leland until the very end.
Yeah, he just comes in and like does his thing, but it's like they're the ones that are at each other's throats. He gives them a little push, but they take it all the way. Stephen King thought that it was a satire of the whole, as he said, Ronald Reagan ethos of greed is good, consumerism is good. And so he really thought that this was like a really, really funny book. What do you think it's funny?
100%, because it was one of those books, and the first time I read it, it's not like Gerald's Game or The Outsider or Salem's Lot, where it's kind of like trying to creep you out. It's one of those books that it's like you're reading it and you're loving it, but you feel kind of dirty for loving it so much because it's just so dramatic and salacious. So I can totally see that little over the topness of it. And you know, this is so funny. I don't watch The Simpsons, but it reminds me of like something The Simpsons would make, if that makes sense at all.
Yeah, I could see it being a Simpsons episode, like set in Springfield and set on Castle Rock, and somebody comes into town and just starts kind of pushing everybody's buttons, and they all end up. I'm sure it's actually happened in The Simpsons.
It probably has. Don't they like predict every world catastrophe that happens?
Yeah, pretty much. So this was also the first book that Stephen King wrote without being on drugs or drinking. And do you think, like, can you see that? Because I know you've read, like, everything, like, that he's written. Do you think that you can recognize that in the writing?
No, I don't know. Because the Tommyknockers was in that fucking sane. Like, that book is so much wilder than Needful Things is at all. But I mean, if you think about it, it could be, because I know it's like satirical and more about consumerism and that type of thing, and it's just total spitballing, but you can kind of see the parallels with like, well, these people need these things so bad that they're going to do bad things in order to keep them. Like, Brian's mother, Cora, who is obsessed with her Elvis picture and little side characters like that. I mean, there are characters who even have addiction because with like the whole gambling subplot.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, why don't we get into talking about the actual plot of the book and some of the themes and characters?
Oh, yeah. I should have said this earlier, too. We should have mentioned, for anybody listening, I would really recommend, if you haven't listened to the Castle Rock Book Club episode, you should do that for sure, because Needful Things is a standalone novel, but like Sherry said, it's, quote, the last Castle Rock story, and Castle Rock has been the setting for many short stories and novels, and Needful Things is not just a story about people in a town. It is an ode to Castle Rock. Like, we see so many familiar places and we see recurring characters and a lot of little nuggets of Needful Things had been planted in the books and stories leading up to this. So I would just say, if you haven't listened to that episode yet, it's one of my favorite podcasts I've ever done. I don't know about you, Jerry, but
I really loved it. Yeah.
It was so fun.
Like, we always have a good time talking about books, which is kind of why when we did that episode, I think you said afterwards, you know, if you wanted to do this like every month, I would love to be part of it. And I was like, okay, I'm going to take that as you're going to be my co-host now for these episodes. and it was a lot of fun. Like, I think we had a great time talking about it.
Yeah.
You can also still join the Castle Rock Club if you're interested in it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, please message us. When we're done with Castle Rock, we're going to be Dark Tower Club. This book, it's a continuation in sorts, but it's really just about the town. So the introduction before we get into the story is so good. Personally, I love it. It's I find it kind of sweet in a way.
Yeah. It's got this kind of nostalgic, like, old man sitting on a porch or sitting at the gas station, in front of the gas station, which is something that I always picture in, like, small American towns. Like, these old men sit, particularly in New England, I feel like.
Yep.
Sitting there in their rocking chairs, and they're like, hey, come on, sit down. I'm going to tell you a story. And I think it bookends the story really nicely.
Totally. And because it's almost like, it's almost breaking the fourth wall in a way, because it's really, it's very much Stephen King who is kind of talking to the reader, and he wrote it that way where he says, hey, you've been here before. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, look over there across the street. And this whole introduction is King, of course, doing kind of some early exposition, introducing us to different people in the town and being like, oh, they're squabbling over this little thing that they argued about a few years ago. But he's also just kind of pointing out all these locations that we know and kind of saying, like, something really bad is about to happen mm-hmm. to this place that we've kind of grown into. So it's a really cool introduction, kind of just bringing you into this world that's already been established.
Yeah.
But I should say, I read Needful Things before I read a lot of the books that are set in Castle Rock. Were you the same way?
Yeah, I think so. Because we have, like, when you look at novels, there's Cujo, The Dark Half, and The Dead Zone. Right? Mm-hmm. So I probably read The Dead Zone first, and then Needful Things, but I didn't read Cujo until, like, many, many years later, and I just read The Dark Half.
They're all standalone books, so it's a little tricky, but there is a lot of richness that gets added from kind of reading the Castle Rock stories in order, but for the most part, it is standalone. It's just, I think he does a good job in that introduction of at least kind of making you acquainted with this town at the very least.
Yeah.
So the beginning of the story finds us with an 11-year-old boy named Brian Rusk. Now, Brian is the son of Cora, and he has a younger brother named Sean. And Brian's mom is described as just being really kind of like a town gossip. Like, she reminded me of Henrietta Dodd a lot.
Yes. And
that was always on the phone talking away to her friend Myra. Mm-hmm. And Brian is the first person in Castle Rock to meet Leland Gaunt, who is the owner of a newly opening store called Needful Things. And Brian just happens to see the open sign on before opening day. So he goes in, and Leland Gaunt's, like, very distinguished and like kind of like a charming gentleman, but at the same time he has a side to him that just kind of, like, puts up the hairs on everyone's necks.
Yeah. And they talk a lot about, like, I referenced it earlier, where, like, they talk about how, oh, they don't want to shake his hand, or they don't want him to touch him, like, them, like, they kind of recoil when he goes to touch them, even though they are initially so charmed by him. Mm-hmm. And I can see, like, Brian as an 11-year-old kid, like, would be probably so, like, impressed by this guy, like, this man who comes in and is so urbane and charming on the surface. And, you know, this is a small town. Brian probably hasn't met anyone like this man before, and so he's probably like, you know, super stoked. And then he offers him what Brian wants most in the world.
Oh yeah. So he happens to have a very rare baseball card of some dude, Sandy Koufax, some dude to me, because I don't know what sports are. And it happens to be signed to another kid named Brian. So the odds of that happening are insane. And it's even more insane when Leland Gaunt only asked for the change that's in Brian's pocket. So, like, $1.17 or whatever. And he also has to promise to just do a fun little, a harmless little prank on one of his neighbors. Mm-hmm. And that kind of sets, like, this entire chain going. It kind of sets the tone for the book.
Yeah, and we just see that that kind of that whole scene play out over and over and again with different characters getting different wishes fulfilled, basically. And, but Brian's like so hard. Brian is the most heartbreaking character to me in this. Brian or Nettie, the most heartbreaking characters.
I was going to say Nettie, which we'll get to soon.
Oh, yeah.
So one of my favorite things about Stephen King as an author is, and we've talked about this many times before on and off the podcast, about how good he is at bringing small towns to life and just really getting you into that setting. The world building is fantastic, and he likes to examine a lot of societal issues through the much minimized scope of a small town. And this book is really just the epitome of that, because after we meet Brian Rusk, we kind of zoom out a little bit and we get to just kind of know more of the town. And one of my favorite things in the book is the town etiquette for a new business opening, which describes very well.
Yeah. So they're like, you can't be too eager. You can't be too friendly. And it's so specific. Like, you don't be the first one to show up. Don't be the last one to leave. You're not allowed to buy anything. You don't want to seem too eager.
Mm-hmm. Don't bring him any homemade dishes.
Exactly. Oh, it's so funny. And it, like, you can just see it too, right? Like, you can see this. These are those rules that this community has. And they're like, because you don't want this outsider, or this new business to think that they're going to come in and rule the town, which is actually what he does.
And King calls that a really Maine thing to do, like state of Maine thing to do, with just kind of how, like, you know, the summer people come in every year. And if you've lived there for a few years, well, it's like, well, you're not from in state. You're still a summer person. So that's kind of like the Castle Rock attitude. But Polly Chalmers, who is one of the main characters of this book, is introduced. And of course, she breaks all the rules of town etiquette, because she left town for many years, but then she came back and opened up shop. And now she's just a local. But she goes and introduces herself to Leland Gaunt and kind of gets friendly with him and welcomes him to town. And Polly Chalmers was mentioned a couple times. I think she was brought up once in The Dark Half and once in The Sundog.
Mm-hmm.
But she's pretty much new to this book. And I think because we talked about Cujo in a past episode, I think it's cool that she is the great-granddaughter of a character that we've been kind of hearing off and on about since, like, back when Cujo came out in 83.
Yeah, and Polly, I think she's such an interesting character, because she's got so many different layers, and she has probably, she's in one of my favorite relationships in a King novel.
Totally.
Because she's in a relationship with the sheriff, Alan Pangborn, who we saw in a previous novel, The Dark Half. But then she's got, you know, she's so kind and she's so caring. Like, you think about the way she treats Nettie, who works for her. And I think that's part of the reason why she initially breaks away from Castle Rock, is she wants to get out of this insular community. And I mean, I think she is kind of forced out of Castle Rock.
Mm-hmm.
But then she comes back, and she's still kind of, even though she was born and raised there, I feel like she's still seen as a bit of an outlier. Like, she's not necessarily accepted as one of them. But that's my opinion. What do you think?
No, I totally agree. And mainly because it's because that small town community is really nosy, and Polly isn't very open with, like, her past and what she did when she was out of state. And she's so polite to everyone, but keeps herself to herself and just kind of keeps her things private. So the town isn't really totally warm to her, but she is involved with Alan Pangborn, who was pretty much the main character, one of the main characters of The Dark Half. And he was just kind of set up to be the sheriff that replaced George Bannerman.
Rest in peace.
And yeah, like you said, they're one of the best Stephen King couples. But just out of curiosity, are there any other good Stephen King couples?
Oh, that's a good question.
Because I wouldn't necessarily call, like, Jack and Wendy. the best couple.
No. And there's a couple in the dark half. I wouldn't consider them one of the...
No, they're boring.
Who else do we have? Who else are some big couples in the...
Carrie and Tommy wouldn't count, probably, but I was really rooting for them.
I know. Poor Tommy.
Anyway, Polly is suffering from arthritis. Hurts real bad. So, yeah. As mentioned, Nettie Cobb is she's just like a general housekeeper, right? Mm-hmm. So Nettie Cobb, her storyline is kind of set up to be, what would you call it? Like a microcosm of the overall plot? Because it kind of happens early. And then it starts happening everywhere. Yes. So it's kind of like the example of what's to come. And it's so, so memorable.
Yeah. So Nettie Cobb is somebody that Polly has kind of taken under her wing. She's somebody who is incredibly, like, painfully shy, keeps to herself. The thing that she loves Polly, and she loves her dog.
And Carnival Glass,
yes. And she had been in, was it prison or was she in an institution? I think it was prison.
Yeah, I think maybe.
For killing her husband, who was abusive, and she killed him, basically.
Yeah.
Not basically, she killed him. and she's been released. Polly has hired her and really tries to bring her out of her shell and build her up. So she's just this tragic character because she's so timid. And then she has some run-ins with Wilma Jurczyk.
That's how I said it in my head.
Yeah.
Who is just town bee.
Bully.
Yeah. Yeah, so Wilma's the type of neighbor who will call the police on you if they hear your dog barking like a few times, or she's just really antagonistic. There was a kind of like this whole flashback moment describing how she threatened to fight or sue this hairdresser because she didn't like her haircut or didn't get a discount or something. just a real Karen.
She is, yeah. Wilma was the 1990s version of Karen, I guess.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
So Wilma, of course, sees Nettie as easy prey, so she starts bothering her about her dog barking, who doesn't bark that much because he's a good boy. But it turns into this whole squabble that just has left the already pretty rattled Nettie just even more scared whenever she sees her in public. So So Leland Gaunt, being new in town, but he knows to look for these things, and he clocks it right away on opening day. They're both in his store, and he knows that there's a little bit of friction. So that's the prank that he has made Brian Rusk do. He's going to kind of start this chain in motion where he gets some third-party customer to play a prank that kind of implicates another person in town. So it kind of starts this chain of drama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it just escalates.
So sad to talk about.
Yeah, it really is. I think, and like you said, it's the first really big thing that happens in the book. And Nettie comes home and finds her dog viciously, viciously murdered.
That's awful.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it was this mounting tension because Brian was told to throw rocks through Wilma Jurczyk's house with notes taped on them saying, "Don't leave me and my dog alone," and things like that. And then Wilma was antagonized to think that Nettie had done something. And it just, the drama kept going back and back and forth. So Nettie finds her dog dead. And then Wilma comes back to find rocks thrown through her house and everything. And they literally are marching towards each other to fight this out. And they meet up on some street corner and just murder each other.
It's so brutal. Like, I was going to ask you if you think this is one of King's most violent novels, and I think it is.
It did feel like it, except The Dark Half was pretty gnarly with
that's true.
Crime scenes.
Yeah.
But I also wonder if it's one of those things where it's like, this book is so satirical, and I think there is a lot of black humor in it. So it's almost like surprising when you're reminded, like, oh yeah, this is Stephen King I'm reading, and there was just this really violent murder on the street corner. At kind of like building up after all these little like back and forth, I don't know, almost like sitcom.
Yeah, yeah. Like you can see it's like a comedy of errors, sort of, like, yeah. Where Nettie thinks that Wilma is doing these things to her, and Wilma thinks that Nettie is doing these things to her. It's all a big misunderstanding. In fact, Wilma's not the one that kills Nettie's dog.
No, it was someone else who bought something at Needful Things, and Leland Gott said, hey, you're not done paying for this until I tell you to, and you have to do this.
He doesn't have to necessarily tell them face to face. Like, he has other ways to do it. Like, there's one scene where there's a character in a garage, I think, and a radio that's not plugged in. Is it a radio or a TV?
A radio, I think, yeah.
A radio starts playing, and it's Leland Gott being like, no, you're not done. Like, you got to finish the job. And Brian, in particular, is just, like, tormented by these voices that he's hearing, where it's Leland Gott being like, no, you have to follow through and finish this.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing too that kind of is running parallel to this whole idea is also the fact that the people who buy these things become really obsessive over the objects. So the entire time that this Nettie and Wilma drama is playing out, Nettie is growing like increasingly terrified that this carnival glass lampshade that she bought at Needful Things is going to be stolen. So like she can't leave her house without turning around and going back to check mm-hmm. a dozen times to make sure it's still there. And Brian is growing just like really obsessively worried about this baseball card that he scored and just constantly making sure that it's still there and nobody stole it or ruined it. So that's kind of like playing out alongside the drama that is caused by buying these things, all like the sneaking around and murdering pets and each other.
And I think like all of them have that, right? Like we have Norris, who is one of the deputies for the sheriff's department, and he gets this, I can't think of the name of it, but it's this like fancy fishing rod, and he's so worried about that fishing rod getting broken, and it's tied in a nostalgia for him where it reminds him of fishing with his dad. It was a different time in his life, probably very innocent, and he didn't have to deal with, you know, the troubles and worries that come with adulthood, and he really like, he has this mythology around this fishing rod, and he is terrified that it's going to break or that somebody's going to steal it. We see that like they're always like hiding them, or they won't leave them, like leave their treasure alone.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much like the middle bulk of the novel. That's all we really read from then on out, is just these different dramas playing out the same way that the Wilma and Nettie scenario played out. So pretty much all these different people in town, they all go in the Needful Things, see something that they need, and Leland Gott says, you have to play a prank on some other person that mm-hmm. is being brought into the story. There's a lot of characters that you feel like you have to remember.
Yeah.
And there's just so many different scenarios that we get to read about. Like, I know there's one that kind of stuck out to me was the whole drama that played out between, I think it was Sally Ratcliffe and her fiance Lester Pratt.
Yes.
Super Jesus freaks, which we'll get to.
Yeah, they're very devout.
And Leland Gott has assigned some customers of his to play all these pranks that makes it look to Sally like Lester is cheating on her, and it makes it look to Lester like maybe she's cheating on him. Mm-hmm. And then that just kind of plays out to the point where Lester Pratt goes and attacks some random man because he thinks he's sleeping with his wife or his fiance. And it leads to murder. Just like how Wilma and Nettie was, it kind of like escalates to violence.
And I think that's the scariest part of the book. Like it's so over the top and it is so extreme. But the scary part is that while Leland, like we talked about, he's kind of orchestrating all of this, but the people are like actively doing these things, and they're all doing it because they have something that they're like, I just can't let this go, and I need this. You know, it's a needful thing. They do these things so that they don't have to like give up this prized possession, mm-hmm. no matter the cost. The character that kills Nettie's dog, like, and I think I can't remember what he has. Anyways, it doesn't matter. But they just all have like these things, and that actually turn out to be worthless. Like, none of these things are what they actually think they are.
Oh yeah, like Brian's baseball card. His little brother Sean goes to see it because he's like, "What's Brian so obsessed with?" And it's just some generic card that's not even that rare. And mm-hmm. and was it Hugh Priest that gets the foxtail that kind of reminds him of his childhood or his teenage years when he peaked?
yeah.
For like some moldy old, like gross, ratty thing that he's helped caressing.
Mm-hmm. And then Norris's like fishing rod is just like a cheap, generic yeah. fishing rod. It's not this fancy one that he thinks it is. Yeah, it's interesting. That they put so much value in these things, and then it turns out that they're worthless.
Like you were saying, that it just escalates to just pure violence out of human greed and selfishness. And mm-hmm. somebody in book club actually said, like, this was kind of, they said it was kind of depressing to read after COVID times because it almost parallels people who, like, literally won't even wear a mask to make sure that the people around them are safe.
Yeah,
and it's like, yeah. I will, and there's characters in this book who it's within them to say, I will murder you because I like Elvis more than you. And I can like, I can have his prized possessions.
Yeah. Yeah. I can have his sunglasses and like,
yeah,
masturbate to them. That's actually, yeah, that's a really good point. Like that, you know, it feels, you know, this was written in released in 1991, and you think like how timely it is now, 30 years later.
Even more so.
I never even thought about that. I don't think I saw that comment.
It's a good point.
It's all about me. I don't care about you.
Because it's, the book does it in such a witty, like black humor-ish way that it just kind of highlights the horror of that as well. Because there's like the really bummer thoughts of like, yeah, this is, you know, what people can fall to out of just pure greed and selfishness and just kind of that sad, depressing, haunting note alongside these more slapstick qualities to it.
Mm-hmm.
The most underrated joke in the whole book, which I love every time I read it, is these people are so intimidated by Leland Gaunt, who is this creepy, inhuman outsider.
Yeah.
And he's like charming and creepy. So they're like, where are you from? Like, who are you? And every time he says, I'm from Ohio. It's such a good joke.
It is good. I like, though, like, so we talk, like, and you look at all of these people who fall victim to his machinations. There's one character that never, never falls victim to it, despite Leland Gaunt's attempts. Well, actually, I feel like more often than not, he tries to avoid him. Like, he stays away from this character. But at one point, he does try kind of a last-ditch effort, and that is Alan Pangborn, the sheriff of the town. What is it about Alan? Like, is he afraid of Alan? Because he is afraid of Alan. He avoids Alan. He closes the shop if Alan's around.
You know, Alan's kind of the town hottie, right?
I mean, yes.
I always imagine him being like really hot and just your classic like hero.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm just trying to think like, who are the top five hottest Stephen King characters?
Ooh.
Maybe it's Alan Pangborn.
Yeah.
The dad from the Cujo movie.
Yes.
Always in
Thomas
his
Jane in the Mist.
Thomas Jane in the Mist. Thomas Jane, in however old he was in the Mist, he would be a good Alan Pangborn in like a cast.
Oh, he would be a really good Alan Pangborn.
Yeah. I don't know what he looks like now, though. Maybe he's too old for the part.
Well, how old do we think Alan is? He has like a son who's away at school. His wife and younger son have died, which is what, that's what Leland tries to use against him, but he makes a fatal error.
I thought he was maybe about like 37 to 38. Hang on, we can find out though, because I got the timeline.
You do have the timeline.
So we can assume that Polly is a comparable age to Alan.
Yeah.
Because she was, you know, out of town for a long time, right? She was born in 1952. This book came out in 1992, so she was 40.
Okay, let's see. How old is Thomas Jane now? 53. He's a little old.
Yeah, getting there.
I don't know that he can pull it off.
Maybe Will Arnett.
Will Arnett. Interesting. Will Arnett is 51.
Oh my god. Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh, Jake Gyllenhaal. Yeah.
For Alan? Yeah, I can see it. He played a bad cop in Prisoners, but he could be the good cop in Needful Things.
Yes.
That was me answering your question, which is, I think Alan Pangborn is just such a classic hero. And I think Stephen King had a little boy crush on him because he's just, I don't know, he just seems to be kind of written that way. Not to say that it's bad or anything. I was totally rooting for his character. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he just seemed like kind of classic protagonist.
Do you think, like, when Stephen King was writing The Dark Half and he starts writing Alan Pangborn, he's like, yeah, this guy's got a future. I want a book that kind of centers on him as the hero.
I think it's a really specific case because I think when he was writing Alan in The Dark Half, he knew that that was going to be a character he was going to bring back. Because mm-hmm. I think, did you say he started writing Needful Things in 88?
Yes.
Yeah, so The Dark Half came out in 89, so I'm sure that that story was probably on the way. And since George Bannerman was murdered, he had to set up a new sheriff. So, and you can kind of see little seeds planted in The Dark Half about Alan kind of, he has like an affinity for magic tricks and shadow puppets and things like that. And also it mentioned a few times like, oh, I gotta go call my wife who is alive right now. So yeah, I think it's a specific circumstance in this case. He knew Alan was going to be reused, but I think he's admitted, like with Holly Gibney, she was never intended to be such a big character in his fiction.
Right.
She was kind of like a throwaway character that just ended up coming back.
I kind of wonder for Alan, like, because you talked about magic tricks and his shadow puppets. And he's got these like kind of like almost supernatural reflexes, right? Like there's that one scene where I think Polly goes almost drops a plate or something and yeah. He manages to catch it. I kind of wonder if there's something a little like supernatural about him. Is there something like maybe something about him that has like I think I mentioned in our chat, maybe he like when he was a kid he had a bit of the shine and that's how it now plays out for him as an adult. And so Leland feels kind of like maybe that Alan could see through him and see who he really is. And that's why he really tries to avoid him for a while.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think it, to me, it spoke a lot about how the town of Castle Rock has its own nature. Maybe its own even like level in the Dark Tower or whatever mm-hmm. you would call it. And he goes back to the idea a lot of that, you know, evil and certain forces might be drawn to the town, but there has to be a good to balance that. It's that whole thing of it, right? Like with Pennywise mm-hmm. on one end and the turtle, the mystical turtle on the other end, kind of balance each other out.
Yeah.
There's a short story Stephen King wrote that's kind of like serves as an epilogue to Needful Things. And there's a quote from it that says he feels he would like to sermonize on the evil of time and perhaps even the evil of certain places and explain why Castle Rock is now like a dark tooth, which is finally ready to fall out.
Ooh.
I really love that quote. And I feel like it would kind of make, it just makes me think that good as a force is kind of channeling itself through Alan Pangborn.
Right. Yeah, there's just something. He's such a great character. And I think, like, Polly also resists Leland for quite some time.
I really liked her arc because she ended up kind of, like, being the one character to kind of step back from all this, like, madness with people, like, needing their objects and everything. And she needs this charm so bad that relieves her arthritis.
And her arthritis is bad. Like, sounds absolutely agonizing.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because she's the only one that really has a legitimate need for whatever Leland is giving her. It actually affects her life in a very positive way.
Yeah.
Unlike some of the other people where it's like fake. It's an illusion. But for her, it really is affecting her.
And maybe that's why, because it's something that she doesn't want out of just pure greed. But, you know, maybe it's something she could live with. But if she could get it wished away, she would. And maybe that's why she is able to resist when no one else seems able to, not even Alan. But she had a really great arc, I thought, because she's the only one that really, like, directly faced that want and that needful feeling. And she's like, I am not going to, you know, reward myself with this feeling of comfort if I have to do these things that destroy my morals. So she's a really great character, I think.
She is, yeah. Okay, so I have two problems with the Polly Allen storyline. And they're relatively minor. Polly has agonizing, like almost to the point of crippling arthritis. And she's tried all of these different things that help. And then she finds something that helps her. And at one point, I think she says something. Once she's turned her back on it, she's like, no, I'm not going to do this. She says something to Alan about, like, how, you know, she can live with it as long as she can live with him, basically, is the implication. And I'm like, really? Really? Come on. Like, you're going to live with this agonizing pain for the rest of your life. It's probably only going to get worse. For Alan Pangborn. Okay, wait, no, it's Alan Pangborn. I've talked myself out of it.
The way he caught that grilled cheese on the spatula was so hot.
Is that what it was? Was it grilled cheese on a spatula? That's funny.
No, I just made that up. Oh.
He also can just, like, lift her up with one hand while they're having sex in the kitchen, so.
He did that. Oh my god, he did that.
That was my other problem, was I was like, this just sounds like, I don't know. I was like, really?
Like banging Spider-Man.
Alan Pangborn's secret identity.
But I wondered if Polly was, I wondered if her arthritis was being, like, intentionally prolonged and made worse by Leland Gaunt's powers.
Yeah.
It seemed to, like, get a lot more grating after she met him.
That's a really good point. I wouldn't put it past him. I feel like he's definitely got the powers to be able to do that.
Totally. And like we mentioned before, the discussion, Needful Things is a story about the town of Castle Rock as much as it is about the characters. Mm-hmm. So we see a lot of places and a lot of places get destroyed. So there's this whole war going on between the Catholics and the Baptists, which I don't even know if we have time to get into in detail, but it was set up as a rivalry at the beginning of the book. And of course, over time, Leland Gaunt's pranks make them more furious at each other over this sinful casino night that they have planned.
Yes, because the Catholics are doing the casino night to raise money for something. And the Baptists are like, nope, that is sinful.
So there's that whole drama playing out. And Ace Merrill comes back, which we talked about a lot in the Castle Rock Book Club episode. There were some really good moments that kind of called back to The Body, aka Stand By Me, when Ace Merrill was kind of thinking about where those other kids were now. Did you like those moments? Because I know you love The Body.
Well, I don't love The Body. I love Stand By Me.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right.
I find it really hard to reconcile this Ace Merrill with the Ace Merrill in The Body or Stand By Me, even though it's clearly the same character. He's just so much meaner. Obviously, it's how many years later is this supposed to be?
30.
Yeah. So, like, he's older. He's a career criminal at this point. And he's just kind of like this pathetic character, really, because he's, I don't know, pathetic's not the right word.
I know what you mean, though. Just kind of like sad.
Yeah. I just kept picturing like older Kiefer Sutherland, because I just think of Kiefer Sutherland as Ace Merrill. Because I definitely, I saw Stand By Me before I read The Body. So when I'm reading The Body, I am picturing the characters from Stand By Me, like the actors that played those characters. So yeah, I like all the little nods to, you know, to those, like to Ace's history, that sort of thing. What did you think?
I loved the moment where Polly is forced to play her prank in order to finish paying for her arthritis relief. And she has to go out to the end of Old Town Road number 3, which is basically where Cujo takes place. And there were just some really awesome moments where Polly walks into that same dooryard where the bulk of the novel takes place.
So and, scary.
Like, she thinks she sees some animal in the open, the old open shed, and the house is totally abandoned. And I just thought it was really cool that it was like she was standing in the same spot where 11 years ago, a woman was almost murdered. Mm-hmm. I just loved that callback. It was so cool.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite callbacks was with Pop Merrill, and like from The Sundog. Ace Merrill wants all of his treasure that he's, that everybody knows he's buried around town. So I really liked that. That was probably my favorite, because I think Pop Merrill is a really interesting character. I would love to read more about Pop Merrill before The Sundog, but.
Yeah, me too. He was interesting. And it also kind of had that vibe of like old town legends that develop, which King did write a short story about this set in Castle Rock after Needful Things. So maybe that was really intentional, just how like we actually got to read the book Cujo. And then here he is like 20 books later, and his characters are now saying things like, oh yeah, do you remember out there on that old town road where that dog went crazy? And that kind of thing is just really cool. So I love all the callbacks and tie-ins. I'm totally here for it, but I can see how it would be maybe intimidating to someone who hadn't read all of Stephen King's books.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure there are ones that like I don't pick up on, but then there's some that are very obvious and you're like, oh yeah, there we go. I'm with you. Like, I love those little things that make you feel like you found an Easter egg and you're like, oh
yeah,
I like this little nut. I've read that book. I know what they're referring to here. But I feel like even if you haven't read any Stephen King novels before, or you haven't read Stephen King extensively, you can still read something like Needful Things and get a lot out of it, because it's not all references to previous books. But I mean, you know, he's written so many books and so many stories that inevitably there's going to be these tie-ins, because, well, I shouldn't say inevitably, but it's something that he's just so good at.
And I love it.
And we talk about how good he is at like creating like worlds and, you know, really building these small towns that feel so realistic. And I think that's part of it, because like you said, so like it's like town legends, and you can just, every small town has their urban legends or their, you know, their ghost stories and things like that. And I think that including those little things is just a nice little, it adds to that. It adds to that world building, town building.
My hometown's town legend, for whatever reason, was that at this old certain house in like the big house neighborhood, a girl fell out of her bedroom window and hit the ground so hard that her face made an imprint in the concrete. Oh. And then they have that imprint concrete cut out and hanging in their living room.
You mentioned that in the Halloween episode. And I love it. I love that story so much.
Why would they have like her point of impact hanging
in the wall? It's so dark. It's so dark. But it fits with like a town legend. Like, and how did you grow up in a small town?
Yes, smallish.
Like, what was the population of your town growing up, do you think?
Around 40,000.
Okay, so yeah. So it's not like Castle Rock small.
No, Castle Rock's what, like 5,000?
Yeah, I think something like that. Considerably less after this.
A lot of people don't like the ending of Needful Things. And so, well, here's how it ends. Basically, Alan confronts Leland Gaunt because he is, so many people die, by the way. All this drama has amounted to explosions, murders, chaos. So the town is literally like going insane, and it moves really, really fast. But, you know, Alan kind of gets suspicious, so he gets some information out of Sean Rusk, because Brian Rusk's story ends with him just blowing his head off with a shotgun. It's really sad.
He feels so awful. Yeah. Because he knows that it was his prank that started all of this.
Alan kind of is, you know, very quick and light on his feet and cunning and likes magic, I guess. So he is able to kind of get the best of Leland Gaunt by banishing him, scaring him with a shadow puppet. I mean, it's really like Alan somehow uses his shadow puppet skills and his son's magic trick pranks to literally make magic that chases Leland Gaunt out of town before he can their souls. So how do you feel about that? Do you think people are right not to like it?
I think for me it worked, only because Alan's already set up as this kind of, he's set up as somebody who, I don't want to say he's outside of the community because he's not outside of the community, but he is set up as somebody who is separate. He stands alone in his, you know, his kind of purity, his goodness. And I get that there's not a lot of the supernatural that happens, and then all of a sudden they have this magic that works against Leland Gaunt. And Leland Gaunt, there's this carriage that appears out of nowhere, and I don't even know how to formulate my thoughts about the ending.
I mean, I think my only big issue was that it was just, it seemed to happen so fast and too sudden.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think because the book takes such a long time to build and build and build. King just takes like pages and pages before, you know, anything really bad happens. Like I feel like I'm trying to think of when Wilma and Nettie actually like kill each other, but it's fairly far into the book.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden this showdown between Alan and Leland happens pretty quickly. Like it's over pretty quickly.
Yeah, and it's not really ambiguous at all, because Leland Gaunt definitely doesn't die. So it's more like he's like, oh, damn, you got me. Well, I'm going to another town now. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of like, wait, what? And I remember the first time I didn't understand what was happening at first because it was so fast. But that's my only complaint with it, because it is such a long book of all these really drawn out dramas. Mm-hmm. So the final confrontation, maybe it's one of those cases where it's like, well, how do you beat it? How do you beat what came before it?
If you compare it to something like The Dark Half, where the climax of The Dark Half took so long.
It did, yeah.
And then for this to happen so quickly, yeah, it's a little extreme.
Yeah, so maybe a tad anticlimactic, but I couldn't feel too mad about it because the journey itself getting there was so good. That I really just didn't want it to end.
However, I like that Leland Gaunt goes off to Junction City, which we later see in the book, The Library Policeman.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
I don't think, like, he's not mentioned in that, but, like, no. That's where he ends up. So, what is Leland? Like, what do you think Leland actually is? Is he the devil?
I would say, yeah, he felt to me more like a little demon of chaos, not the devil. Maybe.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. Who would win in a fight, Leland Gaunt or Randall Flagg?
Oh, shit. Oh, my God. That's a really good question, because Leland Gaunt, it seems like he could almost do anything. Mm-hmm. Maybe Randall Flagg has more stamina and endurance. He doesn't have to eat rats.
I also feel like Randall Flagg is just more like sinister. He's more menacing. Yes. Leland is kind of like a little like tongue-in-cheek. He's like, look how bad I am. And whereas Randall Flagg is just downright evil. Although we think that Leland's a demon, so I guess he's downright evil too. But I feel like Randall Flagg would have a slight edge.
I think I agree.
So where does this rank for you in terms of Stephen King's novels?
It's definitely top 10. Let me pull up my ranking real quick. Because it changes all the time, so I don't want to like stick by that 100%, but it's always in my top 10 at least, so I'd put it right between different seasons, Mr. Mercedes, The Institute, The Shining, it just kind of right around there. I love it.
Was this the second time you read it?
Yes. Actually, I listened to maybe like half or two thirds of it on audio, but I physically reading it, this was my second time.
Did you find, like sometimes, and we've talked about this, sometimes you'll read a book and you get more out of it the second time. So for me, that was Cujo. Like, I hated Cujo the first time I read it. The second time, I really, really enjoyed it. Did you find that happened at all with Needful Things?
I would say not particularly, but not in a bad way, because I think one of the really cool things about Needful Things the first time you read it is just like, it's almost just like you can't stop reading it. Your eyes are just glued to the page because it's so like, reading this book is almost just like engaging in a lot of filthy gossip. That's just really satisfying to know about someone. And that's what it feels like. I think that that's the best on the first reading, but I never regret a reread. I love doing it. And, I always get more like physical details than I do the first time.
So what about in the Castle Rock universe? So we talked about it being the one that we were both most looking forward to. So where in the Castle Rock universe does it rank for you?
It's the best. I mean, it has to be.
Yeah, I would agree.
It's all just, it feels like all the other books are just building up to that. And I think the thing about it that I love is that it's an example of King, I think when we were talking about the Needful Things versus The Stand the other day and like how those rank, and it's like The Stand is good on a really grand epic scale, but Needful Things is like Stephen King doing what he's really good at and like a lot of it, his best, so it's more concentrated, and just he's really good at bringing characters in small towns to life, and he's really good at making these kind of dramas play out in a realistic, believable way that just kind of escalates to this extreme violence. It's the best. Other books in the Castle Rock world are just like, we're going to place it in Castle Rock because that's this town that I've created, but it almost becomes its own character in Needful Things.
Speaking of small towns, would you rather live in Castle Rock, Derry, or Jerusalem's Lot?
I'd say Derry because I am not a child anymore, and when it comes back in 27 years, I won't be at risk, and I don't plan on having kids. I don't like kids. I don't care if one gets eaten. I'll clean the streets up a little bit. I'm trying to drive to work, and you're riding your bike in the fucking middle of the road. Get in that storm drain, Timmy.
Okay, so do you have any favorite quotes that you wanted to share?
I would vote for Pennywise for town council. sorry.
No, I'm just picturing, oh my God, Ryan, you need to draw that. Like a campaign poster for Pennywise.
Pennywise as Trump, that's probably been done already. So I do have a few quotes that I highlighted that I really like from this book that kind of embody it. So the first one, and this is actually from the introduction, when Stephen King is basically talking to you, the reader, and he says, "Trouble and aggravation's mostly made up of ordinary things. Ever notice that?" So that kind of alludes to just how petty these little things are that build up into something terrible.
Yeah, like there's the guy that is mad because, like, he gets mad because somebody keeps taking his keys.
Yeah.
When he's been drinking, and he's like, "Yeah, you're not gonna drive, or I'm not gonna serve you anymore." One of the two. That's something so little, but it ends up escalating so much.
Yeah, and another quote that I really liked: "Everything is for sale because in America you could have anything you wanted just as long as you could pay for it. If you couldn't pay or refuse to pay, you would remain needful forever." And it's just that kind of like dark side of it where basically capitalism and consumerism makes people act in really disgusting ways. is mm-hmm. so disgusting, in fact, that I went through the entire book and counted the deaths. And I could be wrong, but my count was 36. 36 people die in this book alone in Castle Rock.
Because they're greedy.
It's also really just kind of how individual, and it's just in American culture, it's like we're so like individual, it's all about the self and never about the people around you, and it mm-hmm. felt like that a lot to me too. But
yeah
36. And I noticed that Stephen King made a point to say 19 people died in the explosion of the municipal building, and 19 is such a significant number in the Dark Tower, the whole Dark Tower level of everything.
Really?
The number that pops up a lot. So that kind of stuck out to me.
Speaking of which, this has nothing to do with quotes, but it's just something that I thought of that I didn't bring up earlier. But you look at a character like Buster, and we talk about, like, you know, this being kind of so timely for the last 2 years and people looking at it for themselves and not caring about the group or the community. Buster's really interesting because, like, can you not see Buster being a QAnon guy? Like,
oh my God, yes. He's basically the entire Republican Party at this point, where it's like they basically accusing everyone else of what they're doing, in short.
Exactly. And they're watching me. They're spying on me. They're out to get me.
And he basically treats his wife how he imagines these imaginary villains are treating him.
So I had two quotes that I wanted to share. One, because it always reminds me, and I've actually said this before, and I'm wondering if Stephen King is a Golden Girls fan, and I will explain why in just a moment. Because one character says, "I'm having a magenta day, not just red, but magenta." And there is an episode of the Golden Girls where Blanche says that she's feeling magenta. And she goes on, like, "I'm not really green with envy." She goes through, like, how magenta is just this awful feeling, and she hates it. It is the worst emotion that she can feel. And it just made me, like, that line really stuck out for me because I was like, Stephen King watches Golden Girls.
Yeah, I wonder if that was, like, a saying in the early 90s talking about how we kind of talk about people in their crystals today and their essential oils.
Maybe. I mean, it was their color, their aura.
Their aura, color, their vibrancy.
Exactly.
That was a developing science back then.
And then I really liked, it's a flashback, because Polly thinks a lot about her aunt, Evie, and how her aunt was the one that kind of stood by her and, like, encouraged her. And, which is funny, because I think in Cujo, she's kind of portrayed as this cantankerous old woman. But
yeah.
There's a scene where they're standing at it's one of Polly's parents' graves. And she says, "Not everyone believes in ghosts, but I do. Do you know what they are, Trisha?" She had shaken her head slowly. "Men and women who can't get over the past," Aunt Evie said. "That's what ghosts are, not them." And then she says, "The dead are dead. We bury them, and buried they stay." And I think when you look at a lot of these characters in this, they're holding on to the past. So you think of, like, Norris holding on to his fishing rod and that nostalgic feeling that he wants to get back. And you look at Alan, who keeps going back and forth over his wife's accident and what happened, and mm-hmm. did it happen this way or did it happen that way? Polly is holding on to what happened in San Francisco. So they're all kind of really holding on to something, and that's what haunts them.
Totally.
And so I really liked that quote.
This would sound absolutely insane to anybody who'd never read this book. So hopefully whoever listened this far has read it, because I'm sure it sounded crazy otherwise. But it's one of those books that's wild in a really good way. Mm-hmm. Like, I know I bring up A Simple Plan by Scott Smith a lot, but it's kind of that same thing where it's just like this unfolding chain reaction that you don't want to stop reading.
Mm-hmm. Well, to wrap it up, why don't you tell us, what are you reading right now?
Right now, I am rereading Bag of Bones for the Castle Rock Book Club, even though I think it's stupid that we counted it. It probably doesn't technically even count.
I like that you're saying it's stupid that we counted it, and you're the one that came up with the reading list.
Everyone voted for it.
That's true.
So I'm reading that. And I also started reading today, because it was available at the library, Chasing the Boogeyman by Richard Chismar.
Oh, and you've started reading it. How are you liking it so far?
It's okay so far. He's on thin ice because the Gwendy books are so bad. So right now I've just started it. I'm only like an hour or so into the audiobook, and it's like he needs to get to the point, but pretty good so far.
I am reading Nosferatu by Joe Hill, and I'm a little more than halfway through, and I'm really, really digging it.
I'm glad you like it.
And we've talked about this a little bit, and I feel like for me, I see a lot of like his dad in his writing, and I know you don't feel the same way, but even just he's at one point they're talking about, oh, they use find my phone to find a character, and there's Pennywise Circle or something. And I was like, oh, that's cute. There's lots of little nods, I feel like, to his dad. So yeah, I'm really liking it. So I'm excited to finish it and then move on to my next book, which I think is going to be Survive the Night by Riley Sager. But I also have to read Bag of Bones, so that might be next. All right, so where can people follow you on social media?
The best place would probably be Twitter at RyanM642. That's just, if there's anything going on, that's where I put it. I also have a website for my artwork and illustration work, which if you need somebody to illustrate for you, that's RyanMills.art. Super easy.
From there, you can get The House on Newbold Street, right?
Yeah, I do have several Stephen King specific pieces, which I really like. Oh, and also just search the Castle Rock Book Club on Facebook.
We're always looking for new members. And if, you know, just because we're almost done our Castle Rock journey, actually, we're really not. We still have quite a few books to read because we added some in, didn't we?
Yeah.
But we are going to be moving on to the Dark Tower after we finish the Castle Rock books. So I'm apprehensive and excited at the same time. So you can catch us on Twitter at CatScaredy and on Instagram at ScaredyCatPodcast. You can subscribe wherever you find podcasts. And don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. We'd also love to hear what you're reading, so let us know. And until next time, stay scared.